Today on Against the Grain, are mass protests and elections enough to block the slide toward authoritarianism? Labor scholar and organizer Eric Blanc argues that neither will suffice without exerting leverage on the key pillars of Trump's support. He discusses how a multi-level campaign against the corporations and other entities that back the administration could be organized, as well as the state of the labor movement and the Supreme Court, the victory of Zohran Mamdani, and what it might take to build to a general strike. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While Trump's popularity is collapsing, and millions of Americans have demonstrated their broad opposition to him, the administration continues to forge ahead with its far-right agenda. Eric Blanc is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Rutgers, author of We Are the Union, and an organizer-trainer in the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. He was also very involved in the campaign to elect Zohran Mamdani. Eric, looking elsewhere, what lessons can we learn from other countries that have faced and reversed authoritarianism?
Yeah, it's the $64,000 question. One of the crucial takeaways from the experience elsewhere is that the real strategic focus has to be peeling away what scholars and organizers call the pillars of support of the authoritarian regime. So, contrary to what some people might assume, it's not actually the case that authoritarianism just survives via violence and oppression alone. If it were just that, actually the regime would be quite weak. What it does is it uses fear and intimidation and anti-democratic maneuvers to force the biggest institutions of society to bend to its will. The strategic question is, how do you get companies to stop doing what they're doing right now? Just a couple weeks ago, you had dozens of the biggest companies in the country funding Trump's East Wing demolition and rebuild, and it's essentially a quid pro quo. And what you have then is major institutions all across society, businesses, universities, media, etc., that for the most part have been bending to this regime. So what you want to do is build enough organized opposition from below, not just through elections, although elections are important, to be able to pressure those institutions to start explicitly or de facto peeling away their support. Because when you do that, when you get enough opposition and it's widespread enough, then the regime has a very hard time imposing its order upon society.
Well, one often hears these days a kind of fatalism about Trump's consolidation of power as if it were inevitable, as if there's sort of a march that can't be stopped. You know, it's always the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the rise of the Nazis. Looking at other countries, do authoritarians tend to march to power impeded if we look at the past?
There is a lot of reason for hope. One of the things that Trump, like all authoritarians, tries to do is actually give the population a sense of powerlessness and a sense that he is unstoppable. And that's, in many ways, a myth. We can look at countries across the world, and there's been recent research suggesting actually a relatively high number, surprisingly, have gone through what these scholars call U-turns, in which there's an attempt at authoritarianism, some serious inroads towards authoritarianism, but that in turn creates a democratic backlash that is able to actually reverse this authoritarianism and many times actually build a society that's even more democratic than before the authoritarian episode began. So I don't think it's at all true that Trump is somehow unstoppable, but it is going to take a lot more people to be courageous, and it's going to take a lot more institutions to be courageous. And this is really why it's such a tricky moment, because we don't know what's going to happen, but it really depends on what people do. And I think that that understanding, that it's really actually in many ways up to us, is a very empowering idea if we can get enough people to feel that way.
Right, and then there's sort of an oscillation, right, between sometimes a fatalism that I just mentioned, or still pining for a hope that establishment institutions of the old order would somehow pull us back from the brink. And the courts have been one of those. We've, of course, seen a whole number of lower court rulings against Trump, including significantly about troops in cities. But the Supreme Court has been, you know, very happy to enable Trump's authoritarianism. How do you think popular movements should organize around the courts, or the courts just not the right terrain?
It's a great question. I would say that on the whole, as you suggested, the biggest problem we've had on our side, broadly speaking, is that people put way too much faith in the courts. There was this assumption early on, or a hope, that, well, Trump is going to try to do a lot of terrible things, but ultimately, because these are illegal, the courts will stop him. And that in some ways reflected a generalization from Trump 1.0, in which the courts really did stop a lot of things. But the administration this time is much savvier, it's much more powerful, and the courts, frankly, have just rolled over. At least the Supreme Court, lower level judges have tried to fight, but ultimately the Supreme Court has essentially greenlit the authoritarian takeover. That doesn't mean it's impossible to pressure judges, but it means that we can't rely on them on their own to do the right thing. We can look throughout history at how, you know, the judges in many ways, contrary to what they believe, reflect the balance of forces in society, and you can force even reactionary judges to do the right thing. The example that comes immediately to my mind is in the 1930s. The Supreme Court initially essentially shot down almost the entirety of the New Deal, especially the right to unionize in 1935. And the reaction from below was organizing mass strikes. The political will, fortunately, at that point was there from the president to threaten to pack the courts. But through a combination of mass opposition and some electoral push, the Supreme Court essentially reversed all of its policies towards the New Deal, or its major policies, in the span of just a few short years. So it gives you a sense that, yeah, you can pressure the court, but it's not going to happen because of like jurisprudence and sort of appealing to their higher norms or something. It's going to happen because they're worried that the country is becoming so disrupted, that there's so much chaos, that they, for the sake of the system, have to push back against authoritarianism. But we haven't yet created that level of pushback.
In the past month, we've seen the largest protests in U.S. history, along with the historic win of Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani as New York City mayor, a widespread wave of defeats for Republican candidates, and then the capitulation of members of the Democratic Party to end the government shutdown, all have some bearing in their own way on the ability or lack thereof to challenge Trump's authoritarian consolidation of power. Starting first with the election of Mamdani, which you were involved in, what were the odds against his winning? What forces were arrayed that had to be overcome?
The reality is when that Zoran first launched his campaign in late 2024, just a few weeks before Trump got elected, I don't think anybody in the city thought he could win. Zoran says he believed always from the start, but I'm not even sure, frankly, that he thought he could win. A lot of us were hoping that at best we could sort of put up a good fight, shift the terrain to the left, and have a respectful defeat. And the odds were so far against him. You know, he was pulling 1% for a very long time. What he had to overcome was both a sense of resignation amongst the population. Sometimes we overestimate the extent to which it's just the opposition from above. As organizers, and as someone like Zoran can attest, the biggest obstacle we have is people just focusing on their daily lives and feeling like politics is never going to change. And this sense of cynicism and resignation is pervasive. So when you have someone like Zoran saying, look, we can actually make the government work for you, it's going to take all of you to get involved, that doesn't immediately resonate with people. They could say, well, it's pie in the sky. So he had to overcome that resignation. Part of the way that happened was building up a really tremendous volunteer machine. By the end of the campaign, it had over 100,000 volunteers. That came about in part because Zoran himself was a member of Democratic Socialists of America in New York City, and DSA played a really instrumental role in kind of getting the ball moving. And then I would say just the last really important piece he had to overcome was the opposition of the establishment, both the Democratic Party and Trump and the Republicans. We saw that the Democratic Party did everything to stop Zoran in the primary, and then even when he won the primary, did very little to try to prevent Cuomo from essentially playing a spoiler role. And despite that, because of his operation, because his message around affordability just resonated so much, because he's a charismatic person, he was able to keep the pressure up on the Democratic Party establishment, so much so that many of the unions who endorsed Cuomo and were very tied to the Democratic establishment, fortunately after the primary, supported him. And he overcame that, and he also overcame the fear-mongering of Trump. And we shouldn't underestimate. There was an attempt by the Trump administration to essentially blackmail New York City into voting for Cuomo by threatening to cut off federal funds, by making all sorts of threats. And people, fortunately, didn't cede to their fears, which is often the case. They didn't cede to fear. They wanted someone who's going to be fighting against Trump. And it's really remarkable because so much of the time, it feels like the billionaires just get what they want. And they certainly tried to buy this election. In the last month of the election, there was just so much in the airwaves, online, Islamophobia, scaremongering, you know, tens of millions of dollars were used to try to defeat him. And it wasn't enough. It didn't move the needle. He still got majority and won decisively. So it's just really, I think, an inspiring story, not just because of Zoran himself, but because there are moments in history when you can overcome the richest people on the planet. And that's a very empowering experience to go through.
Well, as difficult as it was for Mamdani to get elected, the hardest part, of course, as everyone says, will be carrying through on his promises to serve working class people in New York, you know, to provide free childcare, fast and free buses, and affordable housing. What might he do in the face of active attempts by the business class to undermine his agenda? And to what degree can the infrastructure that was created to get out the vote translate into something more enduring or deeper, since these are actually quite different things?
Yeah, the point of comparison I would make was what Obama didn't do when he was first elected. Listeners might remember there was a massive outpouring of volunteer energy around the Obama campaign the first time around. But Obama made the decision essentially to put that on ice and to not keep that volunteer energy going to win the progressive fights that were coming. Zoran, fortunately, has already signaled and taken action, just a far different approach to governing, an idea, an approach that understands that the way you overcome the billionaires and the political establishment is not just through savvy maneuvers in the halls of power. It's not just through alliances. It's through mass politics from below. And the reason for that is simple. The mechanism through which the billionaire class would stop his agenda from happening is primarily by pressuring the governor and different assembly people to refuse to tax the rich. So this is really where it comes down to, is in order to pass and fund most of his ambitious proposals, well, you need Albany's support because cities don't have the ability on their own in New York to pass most of these laws. The good news is that Hochul endorsed Zoran under pressure. She's also committed to passing universal child care. So there's some space already being ceded to some of his agenda. But the reality is, to push it all the way, it's going to require a huge amount of movement from below. You essentially have to scare Governor Hochul and other establishment politicians enough that they are worried they will get voted out of office if they don't go along with Zoran's agenda. And this is a real threat because we saw that Zoran was able to defeat a former Governor Cuomo, you know, a formidable candidate. And they're going to be looking over the left shoulder. There's already a left primary challenger against Governor Hochul. And so you need to be able to use this volunteer energy that we saw to get Zoran elected. You need to not only continue it, but you need to deepen it in New York City and across the state. And the good news is that the movement that elected Zoran has already begun to transition towards that type of work. But DSA is continuing to organize, but there's also a new broader campaign called Our Time, which is essentially transitioning the volunteer structure and energy of the Zoran campaign into a fight to tax the rich to pass his three main policy planks. And it's going to require that level of mass organizing. It might require some fighting oligarchy tours with Bernie and AOC statewide, because it's going to be a statewide fight. But I think it's entirely doable. It just requires, though, an orientation towards organizing and mobilizing.
Eric Blanc is a labor scholar, author of We Are the Union. We're discussing how to organize against Trump's authoritarianism. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So the Mamdani win is a sort of stunning example, I guess, of what can be possible electorally with a mass base. But are elections really enough in terms of thinking about how to stop Trump, how to reverse this consolidation of power? When you look at the significance of wins elsewhere by Democrats in the off-year elections, you know, there was a very striking turn of many voters towards the Democratic Party. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, are elections enough?
The short version is no, elections aren't enough. It's worth flagging that we don't actually yet have a very good sense of what Trump specifically is planning for 2026 and 2028 to rig the election. I think we should expect that he will, given that he obviously disputed the last legitimate presidential election that he lost. I think there's every reason to expect he'll do that again. The specific mechanisms he'll use to do that are a little unclear, and that's tough for our side. Is it the case, for instance, that essentially they're going to be focusing on gerrymandering so strongly that Trump thinks that if you have enough gerrymanders that he'll win, you know, via the normal quote-unquote electoral process? There's a world in which that's the game plan. That is a serious danger because the Supreme Court is set most likely to overturn Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which essentially is the last blockage on extreme gerrymandering in the South, disenfranchising Black voters in particular. And so if they do that, that would be a real blow. It'd be hard, even if all other parts of the electoral process are still valid, it would be very hard to win an election in that context. Not impossible, but hard. And then the second piece is that we just honestly don't know what else he could try. The possibility of declaring states of emergency or just trying through some other mechanism to invalidate electoral results seems to me, you know, there's a real risk of that. And if that happens, you do have to look towards other countries' examples to see what can you do. It's not the case that they always win when they make these authoritarian, blatant power grabs. Oftentimes it backfires if there's enough popular opposition. And again, this goes to the question of the pillars of support. If it's clear to the vast majority of Americans that he lost the election, is nevertheless trying to use his levers of power, such as his police or ICE or some whatever he has, to illegitimately stay in power, then you really can start imagining something like not just mass protests, but something like a mass general strike. In other countries, ideally, it's not just workers who are going on strike to stop such an authoritarian power grab, but you actually want business leaders, you want institutions, you want it to be like a civic general strike. And that might sound counterintuitive for those of us who are on the left or looking to the labor movement. You know, why would you try to have an alliance with the bosses and all that? Well, the reality is it's all hands on deck when there's an authoritarian power grab. And the goal is towards preventing that from happening. So you do actually want to call on the CEOs, you want to call on the local governments, the state governments, to essentially do mass disruption, to shut down the functioning of the country until that authoritarian power grab is over. And it's in a context like that that you could imagine the Supreme Court, for the sake of the system, saying, okay, no, Trump, what you've done has gone too far. These elections are invalidated. And when you have that type of mass protest, and you have that split in the institutional apparatus, it's going to be harder for Trump to be able to just rely on whatever, you know, paramilitary or armed forces he has. And it could get very messy. But the big takeaway is that the broader and deeper your opposition and the more nonviolent disruption you have. And I think it is important to flag the nonviolent piece, because one of the things authoritarians try to do is use either a pretext of violence or actually actively instigate violence as a pretext for further crackdowns. But if you have enough mass nonviolent disruption, then even these types of power grabs can be stopped. And so you do need electoral focus. I think that is a mechanism and a crucial mechanism for deposing Trump from power. And I feel like there's hope that via the electoral process, we can still defeat the Republicans. But if you don't combine that with at least a serious threat of something like a general strike or serious mass disruption, I think Trump is going to have a real chance at keeping himself in power illegitimately.
I want to ask you more about creating that kind of mass disruptive exercising of power. But to stay for a moment with elites, you were talking about how the business class would be advantageous to have as wide a level of opposition on multiple fronts. As a labor scholar, obviously spend your time thinking about the business class from the vantage point of workers. But how do you see divisions within the business class around Trump? Certain things are obviously very desirable that he's done. Other things create chaos, which often cannot be so great for business. How do you understand whatever fissures may exist there?
Part of the reason Trump is and seems more powerful this time around is that there's been far less opposition from business elites against him. Listeners might remember that, you know, after 2016, there really was pretty widespread protest and anger at Trump, including from tech giants, major universities, lawyers. These types of institutions have mostly bent the knee this time around, and it has fueled a sense of powerlessness. The good news is that to the extent that Trump seems weaker, and he is seeming weaker every day, it raises the possibility for creating new fissures again. I wouldn't argue that we need to like wait for the corporate class to start opposing Trump on their own. I think that actually that's not going to happen. They would only do it if there's such a movement from below that they are worried about their own profits continuing to go down. But that's interlinked, as you suggest, with tensions between the business class and Trump itself. Part of it has to do with tariffs. So the tariffs really have hurt many American businesses, and not just the tariffs themselves, but the uncertainty of what Trump is going to do. It's very hard if you're a business owner to know how to plan the next year if Trump is so erratic. And so this has created a kind of ambient level of potential breakage with the Trump administration. But so far, at least, the dominant trend has been, despite Trump's, in many ways, very hurtful actions towards the business class on some economic policy, corporations, for the most part, are bending the knee. Part of that has to do with Trump obviously giving the ultra-rich and billionaires a huge tax break. So that is part of it. Trump did deliver really just an astronomical amount of extra money to the richest in society. But I think, honestly, most of it has to do with fear, that these are mostly cowards. The people who are running major corporations are not putting their moral compass or their political perspectives over the bottom line. And for them at this point, given Trump's, you know, possibility of retaliation against them if they don't go along, that's what they're doing. But again, as Trump's popularity continues to decrease, as the economy continues to shift seemingly more and more towards a recession, I do think you're going to start seeing more open breaks with the Trump regime, especially if that's combined with mass pressure from below on these companies to do so.
Do you think that that wishy-washiness on the side of the corporate class is at least some part of why the Democratic Party, a very close friend to the business class, has been lacking in resolve in trying to oppose Trump? I mean, whatever has happened, such as the stance the Democratic Party took about the government shutdown, much of that is driven from energies from below, from the grassroots of the Democratic Party. And then, of course, members of the party capitulated, which I guess is a sort of indirect way of asking you, how do you see the place of the Democratic Party in the efforts to stop Trump's authoritarianism, given that they played a key role in fostering inequality that got us Trump in the first place and have been feeble in opposing him?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the fact is we have Trump in many ways because of the policies of the Democratic Party since the 1980s. There wouldn't be Trump without the neoliberalism, the free trade agreements, Obama's inability to really fulfill the hopes that he engendered from below. And in that context, Trump was able to react to and demagogically speak to the anger from below. And the Democratic Party establishment has been even worse than I imagined. And I had very low expectations already in the Democrats. But for the most part, the overall orientation of the Democratic Party establishment since Trump's election has been to follow along with James Carville, you know, the operative, his suggestion to roll over and play dead. Now, that has shifted somewhat in recent months because there was so much outrage at the Democratic Party establishment for instance, not doing a shutdown early in the year when they could have. And so there became correctly a perception, even amongst Democratic elites, that they had to put up some sort of fight. And the result is that you have Democrats talking about fighting more without actually doing much to stop it. And the best example, obviously, would be the capitulation on the shutdown. There wouldn't have been a shutdown that lasted this long had it not been for Democratic Party leaders seeing that the base was so incensed at them, being so scared of, really, of their base, which has moved far to the left. I mean, it's pretty remarkable, and it's just worth putting a pin in that, that the base of Democrats, which in 2016, 2017, 2018 was in many ways really the resistance at that time was behind the Democratic Party establishment. People did not vote for Bernie to give him the election. And this has shifted now where you have normal liberal Democrats seeing the refusal of Democratic Party establishment to put up a serious fight against Trump. And they're flocking much more now to the AOCs and Bernies of the world. And so in that context, the establishment has begun to make gestures of fighting. So we saw, you know, there was a shutdown and it's good that they tried to use some leverage, but clearly the fight was not in the Senate Democrats. And they capitulated, and you could say, well, that was a minority of Democrats. But this is, frankly, how it always goes down in these sorts of capitulations, is they know when policies are unpopular, they don't need the whole caucus to do it. They just need enough of the caucus to be able to make the compromise, and then they take the blame, and then everyone else can nominally wash their hands. So Schumer voted no, said we need a fight, even though every day of these negotiations between the so-called Democratic moderates and the Republicans, he was getting reports. He knew it was happening. He didn't put up any public fight to try to stop that from happening. So the reality is the Democratic Party establishment is not seriously fighting the Republicans. And the reason for that is that in order for them to seriously fight the Republicans, you would essentially have to adopt both the fighting approach of organizing from below, which is just foreign to them. These are people who are just constitutionally incapable of imagining movements shaping the world. And frankly, you would have to do a politics that they've been fighting for decades. They've built their careers off of saying that the only way to win is by pivoting to the center and by, you know, appealing to this, you know, so-called middle of America. And the reality is that hasn't worked. That isn't the type of vision that is going to get people animated to fight Trumpism. And so they, for their own reasons, are sticking with business as usual for the most part. They're hoping that somehow they just are able to keep on keeping on, and maybe the elections will vote them back into office. And it's just really astounding, because we're in an authoritarian coup and these Democrats are acting as if it's politics as usual. And so, yeah, I think it's a huge obstacle. And unless the movement is able to really push and overcome this institutional inertia by threats to primary Chuck Schumer from AOC, I think would be a really great step towards that. And by deepening our resistance, I don't think there's any world in which you should expect the Democratic Party establishment to do anything other than what they've been doing, which is nominal resistance and in practice continue with business as usual.
Well, what about the close allies of the Democratic Party, which is the leadership of major unions in the U.S. What role have they been playing in resisting Trump or not? And is there room for that to shift?
On a local level, there are many unions that have been, to a certain extent, you know, mobilizing members against Trump. And so we saw local unions doing some turnout for No Kings rallies and things like that. But frankly, the big picture story of organized labor since Trump's reelection is missing the moment. And this is different than the Democratic Party establishment in some ways, because I think that there's more potential for unions to start meeting the moment, and they have put up some resistance. But again, the reality is the vast majority of top union leaders, particularly on a national level, are just phoning it in. They're remarkably unable to understand what it'll take to defeat an authoritarian regime. And so just some examples of this, there's been massive No Kings protests. Most unions have at most maybe emailed their members to go out, but there hasn't been a dramatic all-in mobilization of members to attend those protests, let alone do something which would actually impact directly the Trump regime, like organizing strikes amongst federal workers or amongst air traffic controllers or amongst other workers to oppose the ICE raids and kidnappings of our neighbors, or to just oppose the authoritarianism or the sellout of our healthcare or just the oligarchic tax breaks. The level of attacks against the labor movement, you would have expected a higher level of resistance. But again, in this way, maybe it is similar to the Democratic establishment, so many union leaders are very risk averse. They are deeply, deeply conservative in a small c, not politically conservative, but conservative in the sense that you don't want to take risks that could possibly endanger your position as a leader or the sort of stability of your organization. So what we've had is some unions have actively capitulated to the Trump regime. This would be most clear with the leadership of the Teamsters. But most other unions have essentially tried to keep their heads down, you know, turn out members to rallies, but not go all in on fighting Trump and risk what is a real risk. If you do that, you risk Trump going after you. But we've instead then seen sort of this kind of wishy-washiness in which they say the right things in press releases, will come to protests, but haven't tried to use their huge amount of resources, because we're talking about the unions really are the best resourced organization on our side, tens of billions of dollars that could be used for organizing more workers and for fighting Trumpism. They're sitting on those reserves. They haven't launched major campaigns. And I think the reality is you're going to have to see more organizing from below. You're going to have to see rank and file workers. You're going to have to see local presidents essentially throw caution a little bit to the wind and do something like supporting a walkout when they invade your city, doing something like even something more minimal, like can you do some civil disobedience, get arrested, make a fuss when Trump takes away collective bargaining for over 1 million workers? You have to kind of signal to your base that now is not normal times. This is a time where we have to fight. Literally, the future of our unions, the future of our country, of our kids depends on what we do right now. And that level of urgency has just been missing. And if we're ever going to have a general strike, you're going to have to see workers and leaders not just talking about a general strike down the road, but build a kind of momentum and campaigns that could make that possible. You're not going to be able to have a general strike in this country unless you could start getting millions of union members mobilized and organized and fighting around the immediate tax, unless you can have local strikes, unless you can have mass campaigns to force companies to stop capitulating to Trump. In the absence of that, you're not just going to magically one day have a general strike.
Indeed. I'm speaking with labor scholar Eric Blanc. He is the author of We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and we are talking about strategy around opposing authoritarianism. So, Eric, you were mentioning the No Kings protests, which have built on each other. In the past month, we've now had the largest protests in U.S. history. How significant are these protests and what are their limitations?
The first thing I would say is that I believe that Indivisible and the No Kings coalition that they've helped assemble has been the single best initiative to fight Trumpism. That sort of world has done more than anybody else, I think, to understand the stakes of what's going on and to put people into motion against that. So I think that's actually pretty important, because most other parts of the left and progressives and liberals have stuck with small scale, siloed sort of business as usual activism that might make us feel like we're doing our part, but that doesn't really move the needle. And the No Kings protests have been so important because by getting millions of people into the streets, it's broken the narrative, A, that Trump believes or wants people to believe that he's popular. B, it shows that there is mass resistance. And that's important because, you know, listeners might remember early on in Trump 2.0, there was a lot of talk of, oh, why are there fewer protests this time around? Why don't people fight back? Well, the No Kings protests has essentially broken that myth. By any criteria, the protests have been bigger and more numerous than even last time around. And so there is a sense, I think, now that people want to fight back. And it's a question then of how can you deepen this movement so that we are able to force the Trump regime to retreat. And that raises the question of the limitations of mass demonstrations. I actually don't think we should stop doing mass demonstrations. That there's always a utility for having big mass demonstrations. But the tricky part, especially if you want to sustain momentum, is that beyond breaking the myth that nobody opposes the regime, which has already been broken at this point, there's limitations to what these types of protests can do to actually stop the regime. And this, again, goes to the question of leverage and power. And I would think that the direction we need to move, and I argued this in a piece I wrote, and I'm trying to make this case internally within movement organizations, is that we need not just these periodic mass demonstrations in which people go into the streets and then come home. We essentially need mass organizing campaigns in which, if you're going to have a demonstration, you're letting people know through those demonstrations what the next step is, and you're using these demonstrations to essentially onboard and absorb millions of people into an ongoing fight back. And then the question becomes, well, what is that ongoing fight back? And this takes back to what I was suggesting earlier, which is the focus has to be pulling these pillars of support away from the regime. And the good news is that we have leverage over these companies. Companies can't function if their workers don't go to work. Companies can't make profits if people refuse to buy their products. Institutions like local governments, state governments, have a huge amount of power. University leaderships have a huge amount of power, as we've seen already, so some of the schools capitulating, some of them fighting back. And so what you can do is not just protest, you know, once every few months, but you can pivot towards organizing the people around you, whether it's your coworkers or your neighbors, to put pressure on these institutions that really you can force to change their positions. You don't just have to sort of wait for the next election. You can force them now to change their positions. And if you're able to do that, for instance, by, say, imagine we call on every company that currently has ties with the Trump regime. We highlight these ties, and we're calling on them to break. Stop. If you're Amazon working with ICE, there's dozens of them that gave money to Trump for his East Wing ballroom. All of these different myriad ways of forms through that the companies and the different powerful institutions of our society are siding with Trump, we need them to break those ties, and we need them to actively say and just take a statement saying, we believe in the right to free expression, democratic process, and we oppose the steps that the Trump administration has done to undermine these. And if you have a mass campaign around that, then all of a sudden you're not just waiting for the next protest, you're organizing mass petitions of workers and consumers in relation to Amazon. You're organizing local teachers and parents to pressure school boards to pass resolutions that they're not going to be working with ICE. There's all sorts of ways that you can look at pressuring the people over you do have power. And if you do that, it's going to sustain the momentum, and it is going to have an impact, because this regime cannot function without the business class ceding to it. It cannot function if local and state governments are putting up a fight in deeds and not just words. So that, I think, is the orientation we need to move towards. And I would say, just as one final point on this, it's not just the kind of long-term campaign around pressuring. We also need immediate responses to some of the horrible, just frankly, terroristic actions of the ICE thugs that Trump is sending in to kidnap our undocumented neighbors. So I don't think we can just wait for these campaigns around pressuring companies. You need to have an immediate response when Trump and ICE are doing these horrible acts. And I think that what the best way to respond beyond what's already been done in places like Chicago and Los Angeles, which is very effective, nonviolent, sort of just calling out what ICE is doing and you know, providing information to undocumented neighbors about what they can do to stay safe. In addition to that, one thing that we saw a lot in the immigrant rights movement of 2006, when there was a huge, massive push to stop the criminalization of immigration back then, there was student walkouts and high school teachers essentially accompanying their students and walking out. And I think that if you do that, then you can start imagining a level of disruption that will pose the question to the other workers, well, if the high school students are walking out and their teachers are with them, why shouldn't we? Could I call in sick to support my community members who right now who need us? Can I call in sick so that the ICE agents are not able to terrorize my neighborhood? I think that type of sort of potentially viral action from below is going to be the direction we need to move. And it might be another tactic, but we need tactics like that that can really signal no business as usual when Trump is doing these horrors against our communities.
Let me ask you more about that. And I want to return to the question of pressuring the different pillars that undergird Trump's support in the business class, but also the media, churches, civil service, schools, etc. But staying now on the question of ICE, I mean, one of the things that has been striking is that while until recently we haven't seen as much organized opposition to Trump nationally, in contrast, we've seen a great amount of resistance and organizing in cities, particularly around ICE, and not only in cities, you know, outside of cities and rural areas where workers and their families are organizing. And so it's really striking the way that things are developing unevenly. You know, reports in Chicago that people who had no connection to the left, had never been to a protest before, were out on the streets against ICE. So taking what you said, the urgency of organizing around ICE, how do you feel those efforts can be tied together, which is the surges in opposition against what's happening on the ground, which is the most urgent, and then how that ties into a broader strategy?
It's a great question. One of the difficulties we have in the United States, because the level of organization from below is so dominant, there's just, you know, so few people are parts of, you know, democratic membership organizations today compared to the 60s or, you know, a century ago. The difficulty then is that you have a pattern through which there's mass protests and mass resistance, like you suggested, towards whether it's No Kings or really on a more immediate sense in response to ICE in these cities. And people go into the streets, and as long as there's this sort of external stimulus that is just so strong that people stay out in the streets, then you have actions. But then the problem is those actions don't pull people into ongoing organizations. And so it tends to be episodic. You have these eruptions of protests, and then people go back to their daily lives. And so the crucial thing is to figure out ways when these mass demonstrations, mass sort of outpourings against ICE are erupting, how you absorb people into ongoing organizational campaigns in that process. And this is been talked a lot amongst organizers called momentum organizing. When you have these high peaks of momentum, how do you absorb people into the campaigns? And again, I think this looks like, to give an example, so if in New York City, Trump sends in ICE and they're, start snatching just our family members and friends off the street, you're going to see actions like people are spontaneously going to be going out to the streets. In Chicago, that people were wearing whistles to sort of notify everybody that ICE was coming. All of that stuff needs to happen, and I'm sure it will happen. The difficult thing becomes, well, how do you step it up so that people are organizing, not just in the short term, but to stop ICE from doing it again, because they can come back at any time, and frankly, to be able to put enough pressure to really inflict a political blow against the Trump regime and the companies that are, for instance, helping ICE, like Amazon. The crucial thing becomes having mechanisms to plug people in. So I would say, in some ways, it's not so complicated. When there are mass demonstrations around ICE, can you have the people who are helping, MC, can you have everyone sign up over, this is what we did in the Bay Area when I was organizing our immigrant rights, people text a number to get text updates for how they can stay involved and to hear about upcoming actions. So you'd say, everyone, get your phone out, and send XY number to this number, and we'll get you updates about how you can get involved in the movement. And so if you're able to get people's information at these protests and say the fight is continuing, then essentially you can pivot when the moment allows it to campaigning on a sort of more offensive front after maybe the highs of momentum around these immediate actions have dialed back a little bit. So you could pivot all of the people, if you're able to get information for all the people who are out in the streets around ICE and say, okay, ICE, we were able to get them out of our city. They did a huge amount of damage, but now we need to make sure it doesn't happen again. Well, then you pivot around a campaign in which you'd then start talking about how getting companies to take a position against ICE, get companies to stop actively abetting ICE, to get local state governments to take actions, if they haven't yet, to protect local communities so that the next time around this doesn't happen to the same extent. And then it becomes an organizing campaign. So really it requires organizers about thinking already about how you're getting people's information and projecting a campaign and then doing it. And the difficulty we have on the left is that there's a real siloization. There's a lot of very small scale local nonprofits who have their own kind of incentives because they're philanthropy funded. You have unions who are kind of just doing their own thing. And we need to find ways at this moment to unite across all of those silos to project a campaign or campaigns that can fight back and that can excite people to keep on organizing.
Are there any campaigns that you can see that are developing to pressure the pillars of Trump support? So, you were talking about going after the businesses that have supported him. One of the things that we saw fairly recently was how a consumer boycott was very effective when Jimmy Kimmel was taken off the air. I've never been one to see consumer boycotts as having that much power, but in the context of a wider movement, one could see the place for such a thing. Is that kind of organizing already happening? Do you see it happening anywhere?
The initial steps in that direction are happening, but I think part of the difficulty we have is that so much of the thinking and approach of organizers around companies' complicity with the Trump regime has been just to protest companies for doing bad things. So we have, periodic protests against Amazon and against some of these other companies that have bent the knee, but it's not really an organizing campaign. What you need is actually not just a protest, but you need a demand and a campaign to organize community members and workers to actually start forcing these companies to act differently. So as you suggested, one example we saw of this, which was sort of relatively spontaneous, was after Kimmel got fired or almost fired and then got rehired. Well, yeah, there was a spontaneous reaction. Okay, we're going to cancel our subscriptions to Disney. The reaction we need to see now, I do think, is leaning on these sorts of power, but in an organized way. Part of the difficulty we have with these consumer boycotts is it's like somebody will just put out a call over the internet, never shop at Amazon again or whatever. And there's been so many of these that don't do anything that I think we've become a little numb to it. But I do think there's actually a lot of potential, for instance, having one-day boycotts in which we're going to say, these five companies, the five worst offenders of capitulation to Trump, we're going to, on this day, buy nothing, no complicity with these companies on whatever day it is. Maybe it's next May Day. and you can have employees sick out, you can have consumers not buy anything. And I think if you have an organizing approach to this, then it really could work. And I think, if anything, we're really underestimating the possibilities of consumer boycotts because, as you suggest, what they've sort of been done in a kind of non-serious way in the past. But that doesn't mean they can't be done in a serious way currently. And I think that, talking about just next steps, I think there is a real world in which, going towards May Day 2026, if we start doing campaigns on all these different companies, calling on them to break their ties, getting petitions from workers and consumers, then I do think that there's a real world in which you could have an effective one-day boycott leading into potential multi-day boycotts, leading to other forms of disruption against some of the worst offenders. And I think that's the orientation that is going to start making companies think twice about what they're doing. And fortunately, the reality is the Trump regime is extremely unpopular right now. And companies, I think, maybe who were assuming that Trump and was going to be around for, you know, the next MAGA certainly would be around just indefinitely in power, are thinking now, they're looking over their left shoulder and they're saying, oh, wait, like if we go too far, maybe this is going to come back to haunt us. And so I think that there is a real opening right now, because Trump is clearly seen to be unpopular, to pressure these companies. But it's going to require, I think, a real concentrated organizing approach.
So you've mentioned the efforts to focus on May Day of 2026, May 1st of next year. And I wanted to ask you more about that. Now, on the left, our deepest reflex is to demand a general strike, while obviously the efforts needed to actually make it significant are a whole other thing. What is being organized for May Day of 2026, and how would you like to see it broadened?
I'm not sure there's a specific plan for May Day yet. There's a coalition called May Day Strong, in which the Chicago Teachers Union has really taken a lead to organize sort of broad worker community actions around May Day. That happened last May Day, although I think it was relatively small, and there's been talk about building towards a general strike in 2028. I think that this goes to the, you know, the specifics. The possibility for doing something really big on May Day this coming year is there, but it's not going to be there if, on the one hand, leftists think it's going to be a general strike. We're nowhere near the level of momentum and strength that would make possible general strike. But if you're able to do something intermediary, like one day sick outs of large numbers of workers, we're talking like millions of workers, if you're able to really paralyze the profits of these companies through disruptions like that and through boycotts, well then, I think that that kind of May 1st would then get people understanding, oh wow, we really do have leverage here. If we could do it one day, why can't we do it 2 days? If we could do it 2 days, why can't we do it longer? And it's going to be that type of sort of intuition that will spread. And I would add that traditionally the way that general strikes have happened in this country, unlike maybe some other countries, is not that everyone goes out on general strike one day because we call it. It's normally that some workers take the lead in fighting back. It's almost always been the case. Almost every general strike in the U.S. history has come because some workers took the initiative to fight back, and then oftentimes there was repression against those workers, or you know, they were jailed, or sometimes worse things happened to those workers. And then in response to that kind of intimidation from above, then other workers come out in solidarity. So I do think that part of the orientation has to be, how do you start escalating, again, nonviolently? We don't want anybody getting hurt. We don't want to give the regime any excuse to use violence against us. But how do you start escalating such that you could create a dynamic in which, if some workers walk out, others will come out in support, such that you're putting real pressure on the regime? And I think that that type of May Day orientation is feasible, but we're not going to get there just by calling for it now. We need to start organizing immediately, start having walkouts immediately around ICE, start having campaigns that excite people and that are high visibility through Bernie and Zoran and AOC using their platforms to get people excited about this. It's going to be that kind of like attention grabbing. Take Zoran at his best. Zoran was able to capture people's imaginations. If we have that kind of momentum, something like on the scale of Black Lives Matter in 2020 or the Occupy movement, if we have that kind of momentum, then that's when real change becomes possible.
Eric Blanc, let me end by asking you, you just mentioned Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. If you're to step back and look at where we're at throughout the longer trajectory of social movements, I think, you know, there are a lot of criticisms that have been leveled about past social movements being often broad but not very deep. You mentioned earlier the absence of membership-based organizations, a real difference in recent decades compared to, say, the 60s and the 70s. Obviously, union membership is way down. But at the same time, movements in the early 21st century, a lot of them have been very creative in their organizing. If you were to think about this moment as the catalyst for rebuilding the left, what elements do you feel like should be most emphasized?
I think we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We see what message resonates, and the message that resonates is the message that Zoran ran on, which is workers deserve economic security and dignity, and the billionaires need to pay their fair share. It's the message that Bernie and AOC have taken all across the country through these massive fighting oligarchy tours, which ties that central fight around economic inequality to the fight against authoritarianism, because today the oligarchy and the economic billionaires are backing and are almost inseparable from the Trump regime. So that's the message that can speak widely. It's workers are not getting by, and this regime is only helping the billionaires. So we need to fight its authoritarianism, because the way we're going to have the lives of dignity and security that we deserve is by pushing back against these authoritarian oligarchs. The question then becomes, well, how do you build a movement that is deep enough and wide enough? And that's essentially what we've been talking about. But I think that we do have some examples for how this can look. So for instance, Starbucks strike, the way that campaign developed is it started small, workers unionized, went on some strikes in upstate New York, and then it went viral. And so there's a world in which what you do is you're able to take these actions and get high moments of momentum in which everyone is sharing videos online, but you're connecting that into deep local organizing. It's that type of spirit, what I call worker-to-worker organizing, that can be done not just in workplaces, but nationwide, in which these moments of explosion transition into deep organizing on the ground. And if you have that orientation, then I do think that we're going to defeat the Trump regime, and we're going to use that moment of defeat of Trumpism to then pivot to transform the political economy of this country so that workers can build unions, so that economic inequality reverses rather than continues going up, in which all people have not only equal rights on paper, but in reality. And I think that's entirely doable, but it's going to take a lot of action and a lot of courage.
On that hopeful note, Eric, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Eric Blanc writes at laborpolitics.com. He's assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers, author of We Are the Union. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.